That's been a splendid opening to this extraordinarily complex set of questions which are raised at the interface of policy, developments in genetics, medicine and all the rest. Those who just arrived, we'd like to welcome you, and I will reiterate what my colleague said about the facilities here, which are just down out there and down on the left. They are unisex facilities. This is becoming very common. I've never before seen unisex facilities in which the little logo on the doors, you have to hold hands with somebody of the other unisex to go in. I was looking around for a companion, but they are down on the right there, and they are shared facilities for those who might wish to know. Delighted to have our next two panellists who have somewhat shorter interventions before we get into some roundtable discussion. First of all, Adèle Langlois. Squeeze through here.
International side of all this, and I'm going to take as my context the responsibilities part of the group which we were given today, which read that there's a need for a diverse range of stakeholders and representatives to engage with each other to craft new models of policy making, governance and regulation which will connect as well as hopefully evolve new technology. And as Nigel said, I've been following UNESCO's work in bioethics, which includes personalised medicine but more broad initiatives as well, for several years now. And I think UNESCO would very much claim that mandate. That statement is not very different from what you might read on their website about the need to engage with a broad range of stakeholders and for regulation to keep up with technology. But what I want to explore today is how successfully UNESCO is fulfilling those two roles. So if I give you a brief outline. The UNESCO's bioethics programme was established in 1993, so it's been going almost two decades now. And in terms of regulation, its main outputs have been three declarations. So in 97, the Universal Declaration on the Human Genome and Human Rights. 2003, the one that's perhaps most pertinent to today's topic, is the International Declaration on Human Genetic Data. And thirdly, in 2005, probably the most prominent of the declarations, but also with a broader remit, it's a general declaration of bioethics and human rights. As well as the declarations, the bioethics programme publishes several reports, so I've listed up there those reports which have come out over the last decade or so, which I think are probably most relevant to today's topic of personalised medicine. And in terms of what reports it might come up with in the near future, UNESCO's work programme for 2012-2013 will be decided in September this year. And again, these are some of the topics which might be explored further. So genetic testing, regenerative medicine, biobanks, and so on. And non-discrimination up there. There weren't any more details, but that's a fairly general one. In terms of who does the bulk of this work, it's mainly done by the International Bioethics Committee alongside the Secretariat, which is based in Paris. And that committee is made up of 36 experts in bioethics, and crucially they're independent, so they're not appointed by their member states. So how it works is the work programme is actually set by state. So there's also an intergovernmental bioethics committee, which is again made up of 36 people, but those are people appointed by their states. So the IBC will come up with possible topics to work on. The IGBC will say yay or nay to different topics, and as I said, that will happen in September for 2012-13. It's the IBC which drafts the declaration, so a smaller working group will put together the draft text of the declaration. Again, it's the states who have final say, so they'll tweak the declaration. They will have final say about when it's adopted and so on. UNESCO also tries to hear from a variety of stakeholders beyond its own programme. So there are hearings at national, regional and international levels. So for example, when they negotiated the 2005 Declaration on Bioethics and Human Rights, there were several sets of hearings, one of which was with representatives from different religions. And crucially, decisions are made by consensus, and that appears to be at all levels. So the IBC operates by consensus. The declarations, when they're adopted by UNESCO's General Conference, are adopted by consensus. I don't know if that's the case for the whole of UNESCO, but it's certainly the case within the bioethics program. So what we've got there is a good range of different stakeholders, representatives of states, experts, wider civil society. But the question is it a sufficiently robust framework for engaging in bioethics issues? Well, there are tensions between the experts and the states. So certainly what was felt with the 2005 declaration was that this body of experts, the International Bioethics Committee and its sub-working group, had spent a lot of time considering what the particular wording of the draft declaration should be. But when the states came in to make the final decisions, they tweaked things in diplomatic interest, if you like, and some would say it became a poorer document for that. But alongside that, there's a question about how expert the International Bioethics Committee really is. So the idea is that there should be a geographical dispersion among those 36 representatives. And there are people from different disciplines as well, so there'll be lawyers, there'll be geneticists, there'll be physicians. There are actually surprisingly few philosophical bioethicists on that committee. And therefore it's come in for some criticism among the wider bioethics community, which has knock-on implications for how it's perceived by that community. And although UNESCO makes good efforts to try and speak to a variety of stakeholders, it's not reaching everyone. So if you look at the website of the bioethics program, there's an awful lot of information on there. It's part of a transparency initiative. But if you speak to people, as I did in Kenya and South Africa, geneticists, people on bioethics committees and so on, they weren't really aware of UNESCO's activities, so they wouldn't know to look at the website in the first place. And at national level, UNESCO, although it's the UN Organization for Education, Science and Culture, the emphasis has primarily been on educational. That seems to be what it's known for. And consequently, the national commissions, which is the body for UNESCO in each member state, of which there are 190, the national commissions are often housed within ministries of education. But when you're talking about genetics, perhaps it would be more useful to have a connection with the Ministry of Science and Technology, say. And the national commissions don't necessarily always make those connections themselves. I've attended a lot of UNESCO meetings over the last 5 or 6 years, and I have to say, I could count on one hand the number of times a session has started on time, how often speakers have kept time. And so what happens is everything runs late, and so not everybody who wants to speak gets a chance to. Everyone's asked to keep their comments very short, so nothing is really discussed in depth. And what can happen over the space of a 3 or 4 day meeting is that some of those 36 people will never actually say anything at all in their meetings. Actually, a lot of what's done is perhaps is true of a lot of international meetings, as things get done in coffee breaks and so on. In terms of what effect the declarations are having, what impact they're having, that's quite difficult to measure. And that's again because the states put the brakes on some of the initiatives that the experts, the IBC, wanted to put in. So they tried to include a provision within the 2005 declaration to say that the states would submit periodic reports to the bioethics program to say what they had been doing to ensure that the declaration was being implemented. And the states said, no way, that's completely inappropriate. This is a non-binding declaration. We won't agree to that. In terms of whether it keeps up with technology, again, in the 2005 declaration, the IBC tried to make provision within that for the declaration to evolve as technology did. So they tried to include an article which would say, as there is technological change, we may well want to adjust this declaration in the future. Again, the states decided that was inappropriate. They didn't want to leave that door open. More recently, there's been a report on human cloning. That was in 2009. the working group who did that report wanted to put out a second statement in 2011, but that was objected to by other members of the International Bioethics Committee because they said the debate on cloning has moved on both technologically and ethically. Since you produced that report and this statement you want to bring out does not reflect that, you're behind now, said to the working group. And because the only thing they said they could agree on was that they disagreed, they decided to drop the whole endeavour. So, to finish off, I haven't said much about how people are appointed to the International Bioethics Committee, but it's not very systematic. It tends to be quite haphazard. And so if that was done more systematically, perhaps the IBC would have more kudos among the bioethics community. The same could be said of delegations. So when a state appoints someone to go to negotiations on a declaration, not in all cases, certainly, but for some countries, that is quite a haphazard appointment. I've talked about the problems between UNESCO HQ and the country offices, and within the country offices, their relations with various government ministries. So I think that's something that could be improved.
2 minutes.
Well, I won't need that long. Again, I think the discussions could be run more efficiently at the meetings to ensure that there's enough time for in-depth discussion, so it's not that when someone's got an important point to make, they're asked to summarise it in 30 seconds, and then there's never any comeback on the point that they've made. And finally, I've got drop the consensus requirement. I've put a question mark there. Consensus is obviously desirable, but there can be problems as well. So when an organisation doesn't operate by consensus, what can happen is you get a weak instrument because not everybody's agreed to it. So when the UN wrote their Declaration on Human Cloning in 2005, barely half the states agreed to it, just over half of the states voted for that declaration. It's consequently considered quite a weak instrument. But the corollary, if you go for consensus, as UNESCO does, quite often you have to sweep difficult issues under the carpet because you know you're not going to get agreement. And so that's it. Happened with stem cells in UNESCO. So it consequently means that some quite important issues are not discussed at an international level because it's known that you won't get everybody to agree to whatever initiative is put forward. So perhaps that's something we can explore in Q&A, whether we should keep that high standard of consensus for all decisions. And I'll stop there.
Excellent. Thank you very much. And I have a particular interest in UNESCO, so I'm particularly interested in some of Adele's comments. And I might even raise questions with her when we come to our brief panel discussion.